For the week of April 4th, 2014, this is the Energy Gang from Green Tech Media. Hello and welcome. Stephen Lacey here, senior editor with Green Tech Media. Sorry we missed you last week, but we are back. Sort of, anyway. Catherine and Jigger are not here with me as I record, but earlier this week, the gang got together at the Building Energy Summit in Washington, D.C. to talk about the future of building design. And in this installment, we bring you that discussion. We were joined on stage by a few other experts in this area, and I'll introduce them for you. First was John Picard, the founder and CEO of John Picard & Associates. He's a well-known consultant on all things related to sustainable design and was an early advisor to President Clinton's effort to green the White House back in 1993. I asked him to describe that process.
What happened in the greening of the White House with President Clinton was interesting. I was sitting on the steps of the Indian Treaty, at the Indian Treaty Room, and Vice President Gore came by, and then Katie McGinney came in and got connected, but I was so over my head with all the security issues and all of the disconnects that could have happened in the White House that I reached out and discovered Rick Fedrizzi and discovered Mike Italiano and David Gottfried, and that team is the team that really did the greening of the White House, but we actually did the work at the old executive office building, which everybody's pretty familiar with.
We also welcomed Roger Frechette on stage. He's the managing principal at Interface Engineering. Roger has played a key role in designing some of the most visible buildings in the world, including Burj Khalifa, the world's tallest in Dubai. I asked him, since he'd worked on so many big projects around the world, what's the smallest he'd ever designed?
I think probably the smallest project is also one of my favorites, and it was a little laboratory project right here in Washington, D.C., inside the Museum of American History. There's a lab specifically designed to preserve the Star-Spangled Banner. And I think more so than any other project, I left that one thinking I really had done something that was meaningful. So I think that's my favorite. Hmm.
And finally, Darlene Pope, the CEO of Core Advisors, joined the gang. Core Advisors organized the Building Energy Summit. And Darlene spent a long time in D.C. real estate before taking on a more environmental and technology focus to buildings development.
So I actually want to mention I was born at Georgetown University Hospital here in Washington, D.C. So I'm a D.C. native, grew up in the D.C. area and started in commercial real estate here in 1992, working for Charles E. Smith. And the transition between the way that we ran buildings then and the way that we're running buildings now is just phenomenal. And I have a very strong IT background, so to see that transition of the integration of IT into building operations and the things that we can do today that we couldn't do back then is just really inspiring.
Yep, and we're going to get into that. So let's start the conversation. As we usually do, we're going to break this into three parts. The first part, we're going to set the stage and look at what is driving adoption of cutting-edge efficiency and sustainable design today. What is driving decision-making? In the second segment, we're going to focus on specific technology adoption. What are the most important advances in IT, in materials that are pushing the limits on what's possible in buildings? And in the third segment, we're going to imagine what our buildings will look like by the middle to the end of the century, given current adoption trends. So let's get started. Everybody good? Everybody ready?
Good.
So we've hit some pretty important milestones in recent years. According to McGraw-Hill, by next year, or 2016, around half of all U.S. construction activity could be designed around LEED or equivalent standards in the U.S. And that green building market is swelling from $85 billion to nearly $250 billion. With a growing suite of energy disclosure policies that people in this room have probably worked on, and a firm recognition in the market now of the value of energy-efficient buildings, it's clear that we are in the middle of a transition. John and Roger, let's kind of flesh out the changes that you've seen in decision-making among the folks that you're working with on projects. A couple of decades ago, what was driving folks to think about sustainability, if they were even calling it sustainability, versus what they're thinking about today? John, let's start with you.
It was frustration and fear. You know, my clients just didn't want to be left out. Fear of being the building that didn't make the first move to not just do the right thing, but to be just left behind. And I think that's forced things today. I mean, for me, What's changed dramatically is what we've been at for 20 years is now driving portfolio value and unlocking value in buildings that has been very difficult to get your arms around. So, but back when, people brought me in to trade on the things that I'd done in my home, which was published, to take sort of the noise and the story off of a bigger problem. They weren't doing it with the intention that they are today. Today, people, I think, drive toward this with a great deal of intention. So how we did it and what we did was one thing, but today, I think a lot of people, a lot of the companies that I'm working with today, think about why they're doing it much more broadly than just how and what. Mm. And two, up until just recently, it's been a tough payday. The paybacks have been extraordinary. People that own their buildings, that were in their buildings for the lifetime of the building, they were big yeses, but the fast no's came so often. I mean, for 20 years, it was like, we love you, you're a nice guy, but, you know, we just can't move the needle with those kind of numbers. So the paybacks were really difficult, and that's changed dramatically.
Roger, fear, is that a major driver?
I think fear is a great word to use, yeah. And I think I would say you could almost plot fear on a curve. And when the sustainability movement first popped up, there were rumors, there were hypotheses that along with this, you would see increased property values, you'd see decrease in risk of depreciation, you would see increased rental rates and occupancy rates, and people wanted it, but there was fear, and a lot of the folks that I dealt with, they didn't necessarily want to be the first ones to run out and test it. They wanted to hold back a little bit and wait. Yep. And that lasted for a little while, and it wasn't long before that empirical data started to come back to say, hey, wait a minute, this is real. That green value does exist. And then we flipped to the other side of the fear curve, and that was fear that I'm falling behind, that my competition has gotten in front of me, that I need to do some catching up. And I think that we're probably, in my opinion, 75% of the way through that curve now.
Let's get into motivation a little bit more. Jigar, when you're talking to investors who are looking at these new technologies and so forth, and they're figuring out, all right, what's going to work? What's their plan for getting into buildings? What customers are they approaching? What are you hearing? Is there still a lot of confusion in terms of the possibilities here?
Well, I think for a long time I've heard this sort of pitch, which is that building owners get a cap rate on their building. If they actually reduce their energy consumption, there's an amount of savings that drops to the bottom line, and that means that their building real estate is worth more. And, you know, as many times as I've heard that pitch and as many times as I've given that pitch, I've just never seen it actually work. But what ends up working is this notion that you now have the ability to run your building more efficiently. You actually know whether the maintenance folks are doing their job, whether they're not doing their job, whether the tenants are actually using their real estate like they're supposed to or not using it. And they have this ability to actually manage their outcomes on a building energy bill basis. So, for instance, a lot of folks are putting in storage because they want to do demand response and demand control because they were getting surprised with high electricity bills that they weren't expecting with spikes or some of that kind of stuff. And so I think what you find is that the notion of using less has still not like become sexy. But I think the notion of having that data, being able to do more with your building, being able to see it live and breathe has been really inspirational. I mean, one of the people that's done a lot of that work in the D.C. area for Nationwide is Greg Katz, who's written a textbook on this. But that I find that seems to be more inspiring, and then you can finance it and do third-party financing, and there's a lot more money available for energy efficiency in that way using PACE financing or on-bill payment mechanisms or just, sort of ESCO-type stuff, which I don't think was as mature even 5 or 6 years ago.
So I think it's even more. And when I think this, we're in the early stages of building connectivity. We're in the early stages of mining data and reacting to it. And so what I think all of you in the built world, if we could look back 10 or 20 years, if we could write the press release for ourselves years out, I think this is early days of buildings connecting, people connecting to those buildings, and human condition being affected to change behavior, to change the way we are. If we could connect the world's buildings and connect 7 billion people at a time where we're looking at serious climate issues, and people react to those visualizations. If you show people their problem, We don't have time to read these. We shouldn't be managing things anymore. We should be looking at visualizations, and we should be looking at dashboards of life that prove to us that we need to react to these things on a momentary basis. And so I think that's what's really exciting. And I think when we get buildings to head in that direction and people can see that that's what buildings are going to prove out, there's going to be an extraordinary value unlock there, that buildings become even more important. So are more efficient buildings more valuable? No, maybe. They might be, right? They might have better rent terms. They might have longer leases. It might be the one sustainability thing that a company can do is to move into one of our better buildings, right? But when we get connected like this at 7 billion people, and where else do you see that connection happening? This meaningful connection is not going to happen on our mobile devices. But I think we spent so long reaching terminal design on hardware that we've driven ourselves and designed ourselves into a corner of low bids and meeting building code, which is just one step above breaking the law, and we need a big dig out. And I think this is it. I think buildings are going to have a huge, huge impact on our potential for balancing our human condition on the planet. Well, that's what motivates me.
And I think that economic impact is definitely there, and whether or not we can prove it in increased asset value from this year to next year is one thing. But, you know, you mentioned a perfect storm, and what we're seeing in the commercial real estate world is this perfect storm of, you know, the technology is now available, but the technology has been there for years. The economics have changed, though, because as a commercial building owner, you know, years ago you used to make money buying and selling buildings, and the energy costs weren't as important as buying and flipping that building in a couple of years. And all of a sudden, with the economic downturn, people have to now start focusing on operational costs. So you've got the technology, you have the operational benefits and the financial benefits of this green building movement, and you have this overwhelming socio-political movement and pressure to go green. So you pull all those together, and all of a sudden we're at that perfect storm to be able to say now's the time to do it, because we have the ability, we have the economic drivers, and it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I do think the dashboards are very important. Now, I've probably invested a great deal of time in the last 2 weeks staring at my iPhone, looking at my basketball brackets, and this thought that with all this information coming in, I can somehow influence the outcome of these games. But yeah. You know, you do.
You lost the billion-dollar challenge.
Yeah, I lost. Next year, I'll do that. But you do hear stories of people going in and looking at a number of different sustainable strategies for a building, and the only one that they do is put a monitor in the lobby that'll show the energy consumption by minute, by hour. And just that one step alone, you start to see big reductions in energy consumption of the building. So I do think we need these visuals to help us change behavior. I think if we don't have it, it's like looking at your utility bill. You spent $100 on electricity last month. Well, that's the past. I can't do anything about it, so you don't worry about it. If you see it as it's happening, you're much more apt to change those behaviors.
But we need to be the disruptive and the transformative players here. This country, this city, the people, you in the room, we are the leaders in this space. We're the ones that are going to move the needle. We're the ones that have to look at this problem. And I think we have 10 years. I think we have 10 years to shift the value proposition. I think we have about 10 years to prove and unlock these extraordinary value points. And I think it's going to take that long. But you're going to see a couple buildings go up in New York next year that exemplify this stuff. You're going to see the building skin with electrochromics that is like molecular air conditioning, talking to light drivers, not light bulbs, reaching down and talking to the API codes on an advanced version of a Nest thermostat, running back into Con Ed and talking to Con Ed on an advanced demand response. And it's going to look like a symphony. It's all these players who've been disconnected are going to start to come together. And when that moment happens, and when Skanska builds that, or when, you know, Arup engineers that, or when UTC grabs their, you know, refrigeration cycle and ties into that information cycle, and they share that efficiency, and we, every tenant, everybody that walks into a building, we all could have been a part of that guest experience today, and we could have had the inputs, because we're all mobile. And when these two things couple in parallel, and the efficiencies here, and we can connect that way, I think it's going to be extraordinary.
You skipped ahead of us. We were supposed to save the vision boarding for topic number three.
I haven't done that.
I know you got a lot more in your arsenal.
So I wanted to go back in time just a little bit to the Clinton administration. At the time that you were doing your grand audit of the old executive office building, I was doing the energy audit of the vice president's mansion, and the only memory I have was Tipper Gore's drum set in the front hall, which was pretty cool. At the time, I was working for the Federal Energy Management Program, and at that point, the federal government was really seen as the living laboratory and as the leader in driving building energy efficiency and in trying new technologies and in really leading by example, whether it was technology example or if it was financing example with energy savings performance contracting and with the ability to bundle into longer-term PPAs, which they're still able to do. So what I wanted to ask you all is, how do you see what the federal government has done, GSA has done with its building fleet, with DOD has done with its installations? You know, how has that moved forward compared to what you all are doing in the private sector? And has the federal government actually had an impact on the decisions that you've made along the line?
Well, you know, we did have the opportunity today to hear Dan Tangerlini, who's the head of GSA, and talk about a lot of the things that they're doing. You know, in terms of the role of government as a leader and kind of leading by example, there's that one aspect of them being the largest owner and landlord and really living the talk and doing it themselves. You know, there's the other component of the role of government in terms of enforcing mandatory benchmarking and reporting of energy data in buildings, which has become very controversial because in the private sector side, there are a lot of buildings that don't want that information to become public. Or, you know, if you've got a building with an Energy Star score of 30, it's going to be very challenging for you to get that to a point where you want to report it. And it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. So in terms of the role of government in this whole process, I think there has to be a very cooperative movement and a balance between the carrot and the stick, if you will.
I think the government woke up one day not too long ago and said, we're a leader in this space. We need to act like it. And they did. I think they're rocking. They're not fast following anymore. They're doing things on their own. They're looking at their own engineering. They're positioning themselves like a wholly owned entity. They're not waiting for somebody to tell them what to do. Like Sam and some of the people we heard today earlier, I sat there and listening to all the things he talked about, but what I kept seeing and what I kept feeling is, this kid's a leader. This kid's rocking it, and he's working for our government. And the things that I saw today, that these young guys working in these jobs that were kind of like jobs, they weren't that particularly fun 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I was jealous. I'm the guy in black in California, free agent, crazy stuff in Silicon Valley. And I saw it today. He's suited up, and he's going to war on these things that has been my life's mission. And I'm going to go home tonight late, and I'm going to feel good all the way home that I came here today. And that was inspiring for me. And I don't, you know, I wasn't expecting that. And so I have to say the bottom line is things are changing here big time. And globally, it couldn't happen at a better time. I mean, this is who we are here, right? This is us. This is what we're supposed to be doing. And it's been tough. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty in the world. But I think this country, the economy, this conference, the people who are here, it proves that, you know, we can push through these things. So I think government's gone from following to leading to actually asking for the edge and saying, let's bring the future in now. Let's not wait for it to productize. I'm really encouraged by how quickly people like Kevin and the GSA have, you know, stepped into things and asked to do some big and meaningful things. And what that does is it opens the doors for people to feel like, you know, it can be done. And that's when things scale. And that's what happens in the Valley, right, Jigar? We find great products all the time that can change the world. And those companies go on the rocks because you can't scale it. And what this government could do is scale the solutions out there.
I had an experience where I spent most of my career here in Washington, D.C., and then 9 years ago I left. I moved to Chicago, and then last year I moved back. And I was really blown away with the change that had happened during that relatively short period of time, and have had the great opportunity recently to sit down and have conversations with members of the downtown bid and with GSA and with DGS and see everybody sitting around the table having these open conversations, working hand in hand to push things forward. I mean, I just don't recall anything like that happening before I had, you know, left town back in 2005. So it's great to see. It's great to see the changes happening. Mm.
All right, well, let's go into a second topic of discussion and talk about technology integration. You know, I think it's remarkable when I sit down and talk to companies. Again, I focus a lot on this data analytics space, the intersection of IT and energy technologies. And when I talk to companies, they say, we really couldn't have done what we're doing 5, 6, 7 years ago. I mean, the sensing technologies, our ability to cheaply access and crunch data has changed so dramatically that we now have solutions that can be widely deployed in buildings. Getting people to actually implement the technologies is another question. But it's very clear that things have shifted pretty dramatically in the last 5 or 6 years. I'm curious, John and Roger, let's start with you. What would you say is the biggest shift when you think about materials or energy systems within buildings when you're thinking about designing buildings? What's changed? What's fundamentally new to you?
I guess I'll start with a problem that I think we've had in the past and we still continue to have now. When you look at a building, it's a series of systems, and those systems historically have been designed in silos. You know, you have a structural system. We have columns and beams and foundations, and then an architect will come along and they'll hang a facade from that system and divvy up the space into smaller rooms. And then an engineer will come along after that and will hang fans and air handling units and things like that. We need to not do that anymore. We need to change that whole process. The big movement right now on the design side is in integration. And now we see building designs that are coming out where the exterior wall is part of the ventilation system, the slab is part of the cooling system, and it's this merging together of these disciplines that have historically been separated, I think is going to really open up tremendous opportunity for change and new ideas and new markets. So I think that's the biggest shift I've seen.
I'm completely fascinated. I mean, this is not my area, but I'm completely fascinated by like Project Frog and some of these other companies where they literally have, you know, had this extraordinary software tool that did all that integration work. They come up with a building that's actually 15% cheaper than what they're replacing in terms of conventional construction and uses 85% less energy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just shocking to me where the technology is now. And now building owners and builders are just saying, we just don't believe you because it's so good to be true that we don't actually even believe what you've done because we never thought that there was that much inefficiency. And so like Project Frog, I think, has gone from like 5 million in sales to like over 150 million in sales overnight in San Francisco because the school system's like, well, yeah, hell, why don't we just do all the buildings this way after they did their pilot? It was pretty amazing.
So we're coming from an analog world into a mathematically expressed, digitally efficient platform. You saw what Apple did to music. You've just seen what digital efficiency's done to everything. So nothing will outweigh that. And we're just getting our arms around these early stages. Trends that I would watch out for. So I'm building a building right now in Sunnyvale. And it's what won't go into the building that's interesting. So it's really about functionally designing a building with things that aren't required. So guess what's not going into this 30,000 square foot building? No switch gear. So take all the switches, all the wiring, everything that went to the lights, and take it out. When you start removing in-building systems like that, it's extraordinary. Big bottom line savings by design and by engineering. What else didn't happen? The air conditioning equipment, it's 30% less because of the glass that's on the building that reduces the radiant gain. And if the power goes out, we don't have to kick everybody out. The windows will tint to black, and we could stay in the building for 2 or 3 days. Imagine that in New York with Sandy or anywhere else where we need that kind of resilience. And we didn't even get there until it was done, you know, when we did that. It's a net zero building, but it's the things that aren't going in. And it's, you know, one of the biggest trends, I think, is sensor networks and those data feedbacks for the end user. But think of things like cloud-based. So I say in 5 or 10 years, everything in the built space, every light will be IP addressable. every light will be cloud-based. Every light will have its own algorithm of I'm on, I'm off. And what's the next energy utility? For me, it's the fifth fuel. It's all the energy that's out there in the world that's on today that doesn't need to be. And when we connect that misinformation or those disconnects of power cycles to anything to make us comfortable, when we can see that information, that's game-changing. Because we'll decommission not just lighting systems, but wholesale power grids are going to, you know, be decommissioned because we're not going to need nearly the amount of power that we over-engineered for, right, for all kinds of reasons. I just think there's an accuracy in engineering and design coming that nobody saw. And the other thing that's coming is these device technologies are going to create a transparency into buildings that you will not be able to hide a bad building.
What I was going to ask you all about is about this ability to interact with a grid, where a building becomes a resource, not just a load,
right,
where it actually is able to serve a function to the grid and participate really in the wholesale energy market. And that's all enabled because of the IT function there and for the ability to connect through smart grid or other technologies. So I would love to get you all's opinion on that.
I think this is where some of the greatest opportunities for pickup can happen. Just the difference between what the national grid offers from an efficiency standpoint and the promise that that a microgrid could provide, that delta right there would power generations to come. But you know, there's some significant challenges with doing that. And one thing that people often talk about is the issue of storage. You know, how do you deal with storage in that system? But I think that buildings and automobiles are going to start to come together.
Yeah, they are.
You know, if you think about this building we're in right now, there's 2,000 parking spaces in this building. Mm-hmm. So as a gift, Darlene has promised that after the event today, everybody who's attended the conference is going to get a brand new 2014 Tesla electric automobile.
That's an April Fool's joke, by the way.
But you're spot on. I mean, you're spot on.
But, you know, it's a lie. But if you did that, those cars have 85 kilowatt hour battery storage. If the cars showed up plugged into the building and there was an agreement that the building would charge them during the day, but if necessary, the building could draw back from those cars energy, you would have the equivalent of 170 megawatt power storage component to the building.
Right.
So I think that the spaces between those two different areas should come together.
Yep.
The other way to look at this, though, I think, which is maybe, you know, 2014, is that the electric utility company, particularly in this area, as you guys all know, has probably got the worst reliability record of any utility company in the U.S. So, you know, folks who live in Montgomery County, et cetera, experience 3 to 5 days of power outages per year, whereas you have 8 minutes in Germany. For those people who are stuck in trying to figure out how to fix it, Pepco is going to spend, you know, upwards of a couple $1 billion to fix this problem. And there's two ways to fix this problem. You can either fix this through the way that Darlene, Roger, and John have been talking about, and you guys can all get paid that $2 billion, or you can let them do exactly what they're going to do, which is to, you know, bury all the power lines, have DC actually issue public bonds, which you're all going to have to pay for through increased property taxes, obviously. And you're going to let them do that and or, you know, build new power generating stations locally and all these things because DC, as you know, is getting a huge influx of new population growth. And so if folks do this 1.0 and then decide to transition to 2.0 in 2020, what happens is you ended up paying for all of this excess capacity that Pepco's putting in now. You're going to pay for that one way or the other. Then you won't need it in 2020 because you'll have moved to all these buildings that John was talking about, and you're going to double pay. And you're not going to get paid for the privilege in the middle. It's going to get regulated fully, right? So the thing is that that's the choice that you as building owners have in front of you now. All of the technologies that were exhibited out there do exactly what John and Roger were talking about. You can actually enable putting them in, actually start bidding your capacity as a building into the PJM grid using Enernoc and some of the other folks who are exhibiting out there and get paid for that today. Or you can sit on the sidelines, let Pepco overbuild all of the structure that's here, and, you know, have to pay extra for that. And then, you know, potentially you'll implement that stuff later because the government actually mandates it after the fact, and you won't get paid anything for it.
So that actually brings us nicely into the third topic, which is what does the future bring? And I think it's important to kind of set this into two tracks. One is, what will it look like? What will buildings look like given today's technological trajectory and design trajectory? And what should they look like? And I think, you know, this is a conversation that people have a lot. I don't want to repeat ourselves because people are constantly envisioning this stuff. But as we've heard, a lot has changed. And I think it's really helpful to revisit this type of discussion every year or so and think about, all right, where are we headed? Everyone is really excited about the use of data, the use of mobile devices to show people how they're using energy. But when it comes down to it, technology adoption in buildings is still very slow. You're working with a lot of people in different groups. The finance side of the house has different priorities than the folks who are trying to keep the building warm and cool. The sustainability group has different objectives, sometimes without a budget. And it's very slow and difficult to implement these new technologies, even though they are accelerating at a faster rate. And I just wonder, this big stuff that we're talking about here, how realistic is it to think that it's going to be on a major scale by the middle of the century?
I mean, when you think about how systems interact broadly, I think John was right in terms of we sort of have to get out of the shell around buildings. And we have to talk a little bit more about, you know, how we as a society are going to change over the next 40 years. You know, part of that is we do have a big income inequality problem in this country. And one of the major reasons we have an income inequality problem is we don't build stuff anymore in this country. And I think what you're going to find is a lot of this stuff are things that we can build because we do have old buildings and we do need to go back in and retrofit them and we do need to do all this work. I mean, when you think about Chicago, for instance, where, you know, I grew up outside of Chicago and, you know, the unemployment rate there is about 4.5%. The unemployment rate in South Chicago is about 22%. And that causes a lot of the crime that we're talking about. It causes a lot of the unrest, a lot of the other issues that we have. One of the best programs that a mayor can do to actually improve, you know, job performance is to actually figure out how we actually get people back to work to do a lot of this stuff that we've been talking about here. I think when you think about finance, you know, right now the vast majority of baby boomers who are retiring today are getting 2.5% on their portfolio in terms of rates of return. You know, when you think about CDs in the bank, you're getting less than that. When you think about municipal bonds and some of the other stuff that you're investing in, you might get sort of 2.5 to 3. For those folks to actually be able to live on their pensions for the rest of their lives, because we're all living 95 years old now, they need to get a higher rate of return. Well, guess what? What we're talking about is infrastructure, and we pay between 7 and 10% returns. And what you're going to find is that a lot of these bond issuances and a lot of the REITs that people invest in, a lot of the other stuff that people invest in are going to be paying this sort of 7 to 10% to solve this problem. So that's another reason why mayors and building owners can move more quickly. You also see the same thing around water quality and all the other pieces. I mean, here in D.C., there's a huge conversation about sewage and a huge conversation about water. They're looking at tripling everyone's rates right now to basically meet current code. And when you think about all the technology that we have in the buildings and the way in which we can make water-free buildings today, and you can do all of this stuff, that actually could postpone that huge increase in investment in sewage here in the district by being able to implement this stuff. And so part of what you're going to see by 2040, which I think Roger was alluding to, is that we're going to have no choice but to do this stuff because we can't afford 20th century technologies. Again, it's just too expensive. Concrete's too expensive. Steel's too expensive. Inefficiency's too expensive. All of that stuff is too expensive. And so we have a choice now. We either can pay 3 to 4 times more for getting the same stuff as we did in the 20th century, or we can go to this new future that we've been discussing, and it'll be basically at par with what people have been paying.
You know, when you talk about what is the future building hold for us, and I think one of the challenges that we have is it's not necessarily what is the building of the future going to look like, because the buildings of the future, we're capable of building and operating now. I think it's really closing that adoption gap so that we take advantage of today's technologies, because we have the technology and the software now to go into buildings, get real-time information on temperature and humidity and occupancy, compare that against the cost of energy in an open market, and take all of that data and allow the building to optimize itself. We have the technology available now to do that. But we have to close that adoption gap and get people to, first of all, understand the technology, understand the value of that technology, and get people to start implementing. So the building of the future is here today. It's a matter of, are we going to consider that a, you know, the common building 20 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 5 years from now?
So. Another big change I think we're going to see. I heard someone say a few weeks ago, they were talking about the residential marketplace and how that's completely been turned upside down in the last, you know, 10 years. They said it used to be that when someone went to look at, you know, renting an apartment or buying a condo, it was all about how many square feet it was, how many bathrooms it had. It was all about the attributes within that box, and that's changed now. Now it's about the neighborhood and the experience of that place and how it sits and what your quality of life will be around the apartment. And I think some of that attitude is going to shift into the workplace as well. You know, the office building used to be a place where you would put a bunch of desks, and you needed a desk because you needed a place for your paper, you needed a place to plug in your computer. All that's changed now. You know, so, you know, we're seeing new designs coming out for office space that have very few workstations at all. They're more like oversized, you know, Starbucks cafeteria type spaces. They're mostly collaborative with little private space. That's going to change everything as well. So
I see this huge paradox, because what you're saying is that this is all about behavior. This is all about choices that we make. It's about being thoughtful and understanding what we do makes a difference, mm-hmm. and it has an impact on others. And yet so much of what we try to design is about set it and forget it. It's about, no, I want the easiest thing I can get. I don't want to have to think about how much energy I use. I don't care how much energy I use. I mean, so there's this paradox of we're trying to get people to be thoughtful and get people to understand that we're going to have to, in the next 20 years, build in resilience. We're going to have resilience as part of our cost benefits analysis when we do anything with buildings, with adaptation to climate. At the same time, we're trying to make everything very easy for people. So how do you deal with that sort of difference in approach?
Well, I mean, part of what we're talking about is not giving people that choice, right? The gamification of all this stuff, which is really, I think, what we're talking about, is getting people to react to graphs and that kind of stuff, mostly just because they can't help themselves. You know, I think that those kinds of things, we're not saying you can choose an inefficient building versus an efficient building. We're saying that basically that this, it's going to become so obvious, I think, to you that you're going to have to go this way versus that way. Because if you don't go this way, I actually think you're going to end up paying double. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. I mean, I think when you think about, for instance, a new nuclear plant we're building in Georgia, or the new coal plant that Duke is building in North Carolina, and then the transmission lines to connect that, et cetera, they're raising rates 20 to 25% to pay for that infrastructure, just for that one plant. And it's been socialized amongst all the costs that are still there that have already been paid off. So now we're sort of sitting there going, why would I want to do that again? Why wouldn't I want building owners to actually get paid 1/25th that cost, but actually be able to make a living, breathing building that allows me to change loads when, you know, wind energy is there and not there, and solar is there and not there, and all these other things? Why wouldn't I want building owners to get that money instead of the other side? And it matters, because what you'll find is that the calcified approach basically leads to, in my opinion, it leads to chaos. I mean, you think about D.C., for instance, which has, you know, some of the worst traffic in the entire country, right? Whenever they do the traffic reports, D.C.'s always listed as one of the worst. One of the reasons why D.C., I think, has been such a huge proponent of undercutting the taxi cabs and putting in Uber and Zipcar and Car2Go and all these other things is that they have been trying desperately to get people to figure out a way to use things other than the car, and they've largely succeeded. I don't think car registrations have gone up since 2005. Actually, you know, even driver's licenses haven't gone up since 2005. A lot of the young people moving to the district just get an ID card and not actually getting a driver's license. And that's a systemic change that Harriet and others have actually led in D.C. on the transportation side, which we haven't seen actually in the building side yet in D.C. As much as I think we want to sort of pat ourselves on the back, I don't think that we've actually reached that goal here. But I think what Darlene was saying is that the technologies exist. All of you, I think, will be provided financial incentives on a real-time basis now to participate. And I think you're going to have customer demand, but it really is up to you, because I do think that at some point in time, it won't be up to you, and it'll actually just be either up to the government to force it on you, or it'll be your customers that are basically saying, we're going to pay 50% less because your building is such crap.
It's our Earth shot. I mean, we went to the moon in 8 years, and we had all these drivers that caused us to do that. And in your 20-year frame, I don't think we have 10 years to start to redirect things. And I think that urgency is just, you know, not there. But I think the opportunity for us in this country to engineer the solutions for the world, just like we went to the moon, to take a look at the fact that, you know, my dad was a big part of the Apollo program, and he told me, he said, hey, son, do you know that 90% of the time going to the moon and 90% of the time coming back, we were off course? And I said, wow, how did we get there? And he said, we made tiny mid-course corrections. And we're there. And we are heading to these perfect storms. We have some very uncertain aspects around things in the world. And if this country, and if we can't start here and start now, and I can't tell you how exciting it is to wake up and start to realize where we have these opportunities to see the built world and to see it. So you need to place some bets on these technologies. You guys need to work on being in the room to not let an ROI be just an ROI. You need to take a leading position to bring new forms of light, new forms of insulation, new forms of connectivity, new forms of cooling. And if you don't believe it's coming, come out to the Silicon Valley and meet the people, not the technologies. Meet these people and what drives them every day to make the world a better place. And we're the ones that need to be making the first move and having the first mover advantage on doing the right thing. Ultimately, this is about doing the right thing for us and for our kids and for the rest of the world. We are so advantaged to be on this stage, to be in this room with this much intellectual capital, with this much leadership. You guys sat through stuff all day, and you would sit through another day. You know why? Because you believe what I believe, which this is a point for us to bend history. This is a point for us to take a position, to wake up and be the leaders we are. It's going to happen with us right now, and that's really what's important. We have an opportunity to do something significant, something relevant, something meaningful, something impactful.
Yeah, coming out of World War II, we as a country, we stepped it up. We led the world in technology and innovation and leadership and entrepreneurism and took our place as the leader in the world economy. And we've been slipping, you know, and I've spent a lot of the last 10 years traveling around the country. The best practices in building design engineering is no longer in the United States. It resides elsewhere. This is our time. This is the time to take it back. We can either take it back now or we can lose it forever. You know, the technology to design net zero energy buildings isn't something we need to come up with. We already have it. We know how to do it. It's being done. Net zero energy buildings are under construction around the world right now. We just need to remove all the obstacles that have prevented us from doing them here lately and start doing it right away. The technology of getting to zero in energy in buildings is really just the tip of the iceberg. The real opportunity through this design process is to start to tap into human performance. And John started to talk about a little bit about that. And it's productivity, but it's also health. You know, we have a building that we designed in China that uses water to cool the building, doesn't use air. So all the air that does come in the building is 100% outside air. Well, that'll have an impact, right? That'll have an impact on reduced sick days and reduction in healthcare claims and on and on and on. Once we begin to quantify what some of those things are and the impacts that those can have on the economy, it's going to go well beyond what we see in terms of energy savings in buildings. I mean, it's incredible, untapped potential.
You know, and I agree. I think the market is going to continue to drive this. And I think we're in a situation where you either adapt or you die. And there are some building owners who have already, I don't necessarily think it's going to be government forcing it on them. The building owners that get it have been doing this for years, 10, 15, even 20 years, as Heinz had mentioned today. And so those leading building owners and real estate companies who get it will be far ahead of the mandates for government forcing it on them. And the laggards that don't get it will, you know, eventually fade out. Because what we're doing collectively is raising the bar for the rest of the industry, and they're going to either have to catch up or get out of the game. So I think that the market will continue to drive it, and continuing to have people come together and share successful case studies and collaborate and bring the technology companies together and have events where we can have the public sector, the private sector, the technology companies, the visionaries continue to push that elephant up the hill and continue to raise the bar. I think that's what's going to continue to drive this industry for the next 20 years.
That's what we're here for. Darlene Pope, Roger Frechette, John Picard, Catherine Hamilton, and Jigar Shah, thanks very much. Let's give them a round of applause. And that's all for this week's show. Thanks for being with us. We will be back together next week like normal. For the Energy Gang, I'm Stephen Lacey. We'll catch you next time.